I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Talk to almost anyone about the crisis in the healthcare system today, and you'll find the conversation shifting to the crisis in the cost of healthcare. And it's true, Americans spend a staggering amount on health, more than is spent on cars and TVs and computers all combined. There's an economist at Harvard, a refugee from the days of the failed Clinton healthcare fix, who says we might have it wrong. David Cutler says the cost of healthcare is not the problem, that we all likely pay more for a longer and healthier life. The problem, he says, is that we have no way of knowing anything about the quality of the care we're paying for. And so what would you think of a system where insurance companies or the government rewarded doctors based on how well they looked after their patients rather than how many patients they saw? Would there be any way to do that fairly? Could you make the case that such and such a doctor is providing higher quality care than the doctor in the adjoining office? Or would you feel any better about the cost of insurance or healthcare if the system were to be changed this way, rewarding quality, not quantity of care? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Cutler is here with me in the studio. He is a professor of economics at the Department of Economics and associate dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, all at the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Am I right about that? Or at Harvard?
You are correct.
Okay, it's good to have you here, David.
It's great to be with you.
And Dr. James Mongan is here as well. He is head of Partners Healthcare in Massachusetts. It's a health system that includes doctors and hospitals and medical centers. Jim, it's nice to have you with us as
well. Nice to be here.
David, let's start. You've been at the center of this healthcare debate now for over 10 years. What is the part of the conversation that you want to bring in that you think's missing?
The part that's really missing is the emphasis on keeping us healthy and maintaining our health. What we want from the healthcare system is not to be treated, to be poked or prodded. We want our health to improve, and we want to live a full, lengthy, and healthy life. That's something that we are only haphazard at doing. Your doctor is very good on some things, but not so good on others, and the system doesn't really reward the doctor for maintaining your health as well as it might.
If we look at it that kind of a personal level, though, I mean, people are also very aware of what they're paying for their health care. They look at what's deducted on their paycheck for their insurance, or they look at the bill when it comes. And so I get the part of this great concern over the cost of health care, both at the national level and at a very personal level.
It is indeed. The cost is not irrelevant, but the real question is, are you getting enough for it? That is, if you think about other goods that we buy, let's say parks we buy through the public sector, or anything that we buy as consumers, electronics, they cost more than they used to in many cases. And people make a decision about, is it worth it to spend my money there relative to other things? What we know is that people value their health extremely highly. After all, if you don't have your health, what do you have? So the issue is not how to spend less, but how to spend smarter, how to make sure that what we're getting is really worth it, and then saying, look, if it's really worth it and we want to spend more on it, that's a great thing for us.
Now, Jim, I know this is something that you talk about at Partners. I read it in your annual report, this idea that you need to somehow raise the consistency of the quality. Can you take the price tag off it? Just even for the conversation, can you set it aside for that part of a study of quality in healthcare?
Well, let me back up for a second. I would love to think that I could take it aside, and I am in complete agreement with David that healthcare is of great value, and that therefore we shouldn't look upon health expenditures as a bad thing, but should look upon them as a good thing. So, as I say, I'm in agreement on that point. I guess the reason I feel that we can't escape a concern or focus, however, is that there are two issues that raise their head. The first is that I believe that when people make most purchases, they get some benefit from that purchase that they directly see and feel if they buy a flat-screen TV or an automobile or dinner. When they buy health care, they're often getting their health care years later. So there's a huge income transfer from the healthy to the sick, from the young to the old, from the rich to the poor.
There's trust there, too. I mean, my doctor says to me that by taking this pill or taking this treatment, I will be a healthier person or I will live longer. And the history of the system is that I am bound to trust the doctor's advice, right?
That is the history of the system, and I think trust does become an issue. I would make one other point that is that as health expenditures continue to go up as a portion of the GNP, with the federal government paying close to half of the health care bill, the impact on federal taxes becomes quite high, which, of course, in the political current political environment is quite problematic. So in summary, I'd say I agree with David that health care expenditures are good expenditures. I think it would not necessarily be a bad thing if they climb higher. People do want enhanced value, and that's what we have to talk about this morning, and we'll talk about this morning, but I'm afraid we can't get off the cost hook completely for the political realities.
You are both Washington veterans. You were head of domestic policy in the Carter administration, Jim, and David, you were in the forefront of the Clinton attempt to try and find a way of redesigning health care. I have to take what Jim's saying as a sort of realpolitik about this country, that you can't have a conversation about health care unless cost is the first item mentioned. So how do you change that? Because that's sort of what you're trying to do here.
It's trying to change the debate, not to take cost out of it entirely, but to say that we care about more than just cost. In all the health reform plans that we've seen over the past few decades, they've all said the same thing, which is we need to cover more people and we need to save money. Covering more people will cause us to spend more. The only way you can spend less in total is for those who have insurance to spend less. So what people hear when you tell them cover more people and spend less is take care away from those who have it. And that's never worked. It hasn't worked for 50 years. And what I asked myself is why? And the answer that I came to is because people like that. Because people are comfortable spending more if they know that what they're getting for it is valuable. And when you raise the issue of trust, that really hit home to me. What we don't have is any trust that the system is working for us. You know, you're not sure if your doctor is paid to give you less care. Mm-hmm. There's some HMO that's out there trying to make money by denying you services. There's a pharmaceutical company that you're not sure whose interests are they're really looking out for. The whole issue of trust is tied up with the issue of value and giving people high value for their care. That's where the debate needs to change, not to say we need to save money because saving money is good, but to say we need to spend more where it's worth it and less if it's not worth it. And if that's overall less money, that's good. But if it's more money, we shouldn't be afraid of that.
So let's take this part about measuring quality of health care. You have two heart patients that go in to see the same doctor. One dies, one survives. Did one get better health care than the other? I don't know how you measure the quality of medical care.
It's very interesting. The example you gave is exactly the right one. In a number of states pioneered by New York State and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and California, now Massachusetts, hospitals are required to report to the government, to a government agency, the characteristics of all the patients who came in, who, let's say, received bypass surgery, which is a very intensive surgical operation for people with heart difficulty, whether the patient survived and some measure of complications often. And what researchers do, is they then compare different hospitals and different doctors, adjusting for how sick the patients are. So a doctor who sees more patients with very severe disease is given a correction for that. That is, if their patients do worse, that's not seen as bad.
But it's very subjective, isn't it, David? Because nobody really knows. I mean, do you factor in my weight, my history as a smoker, my stress at work, all these things that will be a factor in judging my care and the quality, or my health and the quality of the care?
In fact, the adjustment factors were actually developed by the cardiac physicians, cardiac surgeons, who said, you know what? These are the really good indicators of how sick the patient was. And then what the states did was they worked off what the doctors told them. So there was immediate buy-in from the physicians that this was good quality care. And what we've seen in those circumstances is the doctors no longer complain, oh, gee, I'm doing poorly, or the hospitals don't complain, I'm doing poorly because my patients are sicker. That argument doesn't wash, because this was developed by the medical community to say, here is really the right way to measure quality.
Jim, you work with a lot of doctors, and doctors are, by their very nature, pretty independent characters, some who don't even like to share the kind of information that David's talking about here. Is there any kind of a shift that you see and a willingness to say, all right, how does my quality of care match up against, you know, someone who has an office next to mine or someone on the other side of the country?
You know, I think there is a shift, and I think there is a growing willingness and a growing understanding. Again, I find myself in almost complete agreement with David's thoughts and where he's trying to go and the importance of pay for performance. Having said that, I think that we are still in the early stages of this, and I think that's something that has many physicians justifiably concerned about the pace with which we go down this path. The example we've just been using is, in a sense, a very good example, but also I would submit one of the easiest ones. It's a discrete procedure performed predominantly at hospitals that do a fair number of them. I think where we run into difficulty in implementing pay for performance is, what about far less discrete things like the patient who's got five different diagnoses and is coming into your office for continued care over a 2-year period of time? How do you measure that quite as well? What about small numbers? What about a doctor who doesn't have 100 heart disease patients but only 3 heart disease patients? So there are many, many steps to get to where I think we would like to be in terms of being able to fully implement pay for performance. But having said that, we're doing it already, and it's important.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, a chance for you to weigh in on the cost of the care that you're getting. Would you be a little happier knowing that the money that you're spending was going to doctors who maintained a certain level of quality, whether it's monitored by a government bureaucracy or even by their own peers? Would you be happier paying more for health care if you had that assurance of quality? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. How much is your health care worth? How much is your health worth? Maybe that's the proper question. 1-800-423-8255. David Cutler is here with me. He's a professor of economics in the Department of Economics at the Kennedy School of Government and associate dean in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences for Social Sciences. James Mongan is president and CEO of Partners Healthcare Boston. That's an integrated health care system founded about 11 years ago by the Mass General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital. It is not an HMO. It is a gathering of doctors and hospitals and, is that right? Doctors and
That's
hospitals?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
That's correct.
Important, I think, to have that distinction. David, let's talk a little bit about Jim's reservation here on how you measure health care. It's true. You've got some, you know, maybe crackerjack doctor in a small town working with without the great technical facilities of, you know, hospitals and places in Boston. Maybe sees a heart patient or two a year. How do you measure the quality of that person's care?
There are three ways you can measure the quality of health care. One is the way we were talking about with the cardiac physicians who do a lot of mm-hmm. surgeries, is you actually measure the outcome. For example, did the patient live? Was the patient ambulatory? Is the impairment resolved? And that, as Jim was saying and as you were saying, it's exactly true. You need enough patients to where you can really measure that well. The second way, which would really work a lot better for, say, the rural physician who's not seeing very many patients or for a generalist who's seeing a wide variety of patients, is we can measure whether the process of care was appropriate. Let me give you an example. Patients with diabetes should have annually their eyes checked and their extremities checked. Mm-hmm. They should have their blood sugar levels measured about every 3 months. They should have cholesterol screens done. We know if those were done. We know if those were recommended. We know whether the patient followed up.
You mean that reporting system's already in place for all doctors or just for some in these pilot programs?
For some in these pilot programs, okay. But there's no reason why we couldn't know it.
Okay.
For many more of the doctors. And so we can grade doctors, if you will. We can measure doctors on how well they do with diabetic patients, hypertensive patients, patients with mental illness, patients
right.
with other kinds of chronic diseases. Even if you're not seeing a lot of any one type of patient, those are the things that all doctors, all primary care physicians are seeing.
And you're going to reward the doctor for going through all those steps.
Absolutely right.
That money comes from the insurance company. It comes from the government. Jim makes the point that half the money's government money. Is there any kind of a willingness to use a quality measure here?
There is. We're beginning to see movements towards that direction. For example, the federal government in Medicare now does a little bit that way, not an enormous amount, but it's experimenting. The VA system has actually done much more. And a number of insurers in various parts of the country, private insurers, have contracted with big hospital systems like Jim System Partners or big HMOs like Kaiser Healthcare in California, Group Health Cooperative in Seattle, Health Partners in Minneapolis, Minnesota, are paying their own physicians that way. They're working with them to really implement these kinds of systems.
There's a bonus. There's some kind of extra money for the physician to do that extra work.
There's extra money, and there's also information technology, which is provided by the insurer in many cases. So they will give the doctors the computers. They will pay for nurses who will help work with the patients, for example, calling up patients and saying, you really should come in for your three-month visit. We haven't seen you. When can we schedule it?
Right.
Education materials to patients. Are you sure that you're doing this? Let us help you figure out how to manage your disease.
Let me turn to Jim here. I mean, I hate to be cold-hearted about this, but is money the thing that's going to make the difference, the incentive that doctors need to do this kind of extra work?
Dick, I think incentives are part of the answer, but I think there's another very important part, and as I hear listen to David talk, it resonates. I believe that to make many of these advances, you really have to move medical care towards an area where physicians and hospitals are more organized into systems than being kind of one-off practitioners and facilities. To do a lot of the kinds of things David's talked about, which we're doing at Partners, we're measuring the care of diabetics, we're doing the disease management, we're providing the backup nurse services. But to do those well, you have to have your physicians linked through hopefully electronic medical records, which allow them to keep track of what they've done for the diabetics and for the heart disease patients and have the appropriate prompts so that it will help them do the foot exam or the eye exam. So I believe that incentives are a part of the answer, but I believe that another part of the answer is getting physicians and hospitals organized into systems where they can put in place the kind of infrastructure that's so important to assist in meeting these goals.
Let's take our first call. This is coming in from Greensboro, North Carolina. Doug's on the line. Hello, Doug.
Hi. Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
As a semi-retired emergency room physician, I don't do emergency now, but I did. I can tell you that with HMOs, you know, there are patients that you see and you find that something's wrong with them and you don't have any idea how you ever figured out what it was. It's a mystery that, you know, that you realize that this patient who had a headache had an aneurysm and should have had a CT and that the other one was just trying to get off work. It is such an art that I really wonder about measuring something. There's such a feeling you have to have for the patient. Is this patient going to go home and be fine, or is this patient going to go home and get really sick? And it takes him, you know, it takes experience and it takes eyeballing it and measuring that sort of thing. Is I don't see how you're going to possibly do that.
Well, Doug, let's say, for example, we didn't do it on the basis of the five patients that you saw on a given day, but we saw it on the basis of the 250 patients you saw in a given year. Does it become any more useful, this idea of trying to figure out if you're good at what you do?
Well, you know, you can usually, I'll tell you, if you're in a town and you don't know your way around, call the emergency room and ask the nurses for a good doctor. They'll tell you who the good ones are. But you know, it's so easy to cover your tracks. In other words, you know, if you're fouling up, it's so easy to cover your tracks. You just say the patient was sicker than they were, and then they got better. I don't want to cast aspersions, and I think 99% of doctors really are pretty good guys and women trying to do a good job. But, you know, as far as the idea of weeding out the bad ones, believe me, there's too many ways you can cover your tracks.
What do you think, David? You know a little bit about this, and Jim, I want to hear from you as well.
Doug, it raises a couple of very good points. One is the need to avoid Enron-style accounting. That is, any time you measure something, you have to be sure that what you're measuring is, in fact, correct, and that's an important part of any healthcare system. But I think you really hit on this central issue, which is what may be small for any individual physician will be a big part of the health system. So one asks the question, why is it that there isn't more consultation? Jim brought this up. Why isn't there more consultation between a doctor who gets a certain condition only infrequently and doctors who see that a lot? And how come it is that there's no money in the system to say, you know what, let's get the best person involved?
So you're saying go so far as to provide some incentive, financial or otherwise, for the doctor to make the call, to say, who is the specialist in this particular ailment?
There's absolutely no incentive that a doctor has to consult with any other physician about it, any more than there is an incentive to have looked through the past 100,000 patients with that similar set of conditions and say, what do we know about what's effective here? A good doctor will do that largely out of his or her own time, uncompensated.
All right. And Jim, to Doug's point that you could basically design your own history as a physician to make yourself look as quality conscious as you possibly could, is he right?
Well, if I could step to Doug's first point for just a moment about medicine being an art as well as a science, which I believe is in fact correct, but I think it's important that we not kind of let the art stand in our way of measuring the science part. I think most of us know that there are all too many instances in the United States where the gap between what we know and what we do in medicine is simply too large. We know that most heart attack patients should receive beta blockers and aspirins. We know that many, many heart attack patients don't. So yes, there is an art component to medicine, but we must measure the science component as carefully as we can. I've told you about all the difficulties. There are difficulties. Yes, there are ways you can fiddle with data, but on the other hand, these are not reasons to not do the best we can in attempting to measure the scientific component of the care.
Back to Doug in Greensboro. You're, as you mentioned, a doctor. Do you think that there is room to do a better job figuring out who the better doctors are?
No, as to the things like, you know, did the patient get an aspirin? Did the patient get beta blockers? Was the MI recognized quickly enough? Did the patient, you know, get the option of a thrombolytics and that kind of thing like that? Yes, we measure those. Every place I've ever worked measured those. I'm not actively with a hospital right now, but every place I ever worked, we measured those. We kept track of that, and mostly we kept track of it for ourselves. I mean, we wanted to know were we on the ball, but I do think that's reasonable. But as far as, you know...
But are you ready to share that information so I can see it, so the head of the hospital can see it, so some government bureaucracy can say, oh, yeah, he did everything he could under the circumstances?
As far as I know, you know, when a mistake is made, there's something called a pink sheet, which is generally kept secret. And the point of it is so that people will come forward and admit when they made a mistake.
Right.
You know, and I think that would be a shame to lose that because, you know, through that process, I've seen people say, you know, come in and say, you know, I'm not good at this. I'm not good at the ER. I need to go somewhere where, you know, I can do better. And I've seen people actually make changes that were needed through that process, and I'd hate to see that go away.
There is a kind of big brother element to this, Jim, that I'm wondering if you have any reservations about. I'm quite sure some of your doctors would have reservations about everything that they did because every patient is different, right?
No question about that, and that's why, as I indicated, we're in early stages of something that I think has some promise but is not an answer to everything. I think that value is important in healthcare. I think as we continue to spend more for healthcare, people are going to demand some accountability and some measurement of that value, and I think it's entirely appropriate for the payers, whether they're private payers or government payers or the public, to want to have some further understanding about that value. On the other hand, I think we all have to understand that this is a complex thing to measure. It is a difficult thing to measure. We're crawling before we're walking, and I think that an appropriate note of caution is important as we proceed down this path.
Let me just add that measurement is a part of this, and the measurement to many doctors sounds poor. They say, well, how can I actually improve my patients given what I'm being paid now and the way that that's happening? An equally important part is helping the doctors to do this better. So you can't really go to a doctor and say, look, we know your outcomes are poor, and we know that if you spent another 10 hours contacting your patients either electronically or on the telephone, that their care would improve, and you know that, and we know that, so we want you to do that out of the goodness of your heart.
Mm-hmm.
What you really have to do is say, we want to measure it, we want to be clear about this, but we are going to provide the resources that help you make this happen. And every doctor that you talk to knows that care is not what it ought to be. And, you know, people are not coming in for the screening test they ought to. They're not getting the blood testing. They're not getting mammograms.
But you're rewarding or penalizing the physician based on the whims of the patient. If I'm told to take some pills and I don't, as a patient, I should take some responsibility for you know, my laziness in looking after my own health. But it sounds to me like you're saying, you know what? It ought to be the doctor and the doctor's office that bear that responsibility.
It's actually, I think, some of it's the patient, some of it's the doctor, and some of that's actually the insurer or the big group.
Right.
So let me give you an example what the really good HMOs do, a place like Health Partners in Minneapolis. What they do is they hire specialized nurses to deal with patients. They prepare charts for physicians saying, here's all your patients with diabetes. Here's how many have come in recently. Would you like us to call the others? Here are the nurses who can call them, talk with them. If they're having minor complications, the nurses can deal with them. Would you like us to bring in the endocrinologist for a consultation? Oh, by the way, we'll send educational materials to the patient. We'll work with the patients in groups. So we will help you do as much of this as we possibly can do. We want your help because the patient trusts you and because the patient needs you for some things. But this is not just us coming in with a stick and beating up on you and saying,
the idea being also that that kind of preventative health care is going to be cost effective in the long run if people actually go through with their course of treatment. Is that right?
In fact, what we know is that those programs have enormously beneficial impacts for patients. The cost is a bit tricky because in the short run, it costs more money. The
right.
patients see the doctors more. They take their medications. They get their testing. About 5 or 10 years down the road, there are some savings. Patients are in the emergency room less often. They're having heart attacks less frequently. Many of those patients, unfortunately, will have left the health plan by then. They'll be on Medicare. They'll be in another employer working for someone else. It's actually not such a great financial proposition for the insurers to do. It's one of the big problems. Great care. Not a lot of money in it.
My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Sumter, South Carolina. John's with us. Hi, John.
How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. Tell me what you think.
What I think is I'm sure that there's some good doctors and there's some bad doctors, and just as there isn't any walk of life. But to provide doctors with incentive payments to do their job and to do what they're trained to do is absolutely preposterous. I mean, a doctor's going to do what they do, and they're going to do it the best they can, because I don't think there's any doctors out there that want to give a partial measure of treatment to any patient, no matter what. I think what it comes down to is that in this particular country right now, we're so overburdened with costs of health insurance and costs of health care in general that people just can't handle it, and that's the problem. That's what has to be solved.
No, I hear what you're saying, John. Jim Monga, just this point about you used a phrase at the a little earlier in the program, pay for performance. The difference between pay for performance and fee for service, is that what John's talking about here in the language of the people who study this? That part of the problem right now is that, yes, while the doctor may be the very best that he or she can be, he or she's being rewarded for the number of people they see rather than being rewarded for, you know, managing the diseases or managing the patients as they come in.
Well, I think we are talking about a distinction between fee for service and pay for performance, but I would make two points about what the caller was just saying. This shouldn't be, to my mind, about good doctors versus bad doctors. I agree most, the vast majority of doctors are doing their very best to be good doctors. I believe, again, this is about building the systems and the level of organization so that those good doctors have the support they need to carry out the kind of sophisticated medicine that they'd like to be practicing. So in my mind, this is something about incentives, but it's mostly about trying to organize systems of care so we can do the things that David was talking about that we're doing right here in Boston. We're able to have programs to manage our ill patients with congestive failure and cut their hospitalizations by 20%. We're able to cut the cost of our prescription drugs through using electronic ordering, but it does take organization to do those things.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about healthcare. Should we be talking about cost? Should we be talking about quality? Does one exclude or include the other? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. With me in the studio, James Mongan, President and CEO of Partners Healthcare Boston, and David Cutler, Professor of Economics in the Department of Economics at the Kennedy School of Government. And we're talking about trying to measure the quality of healthcare and whether or not that kind of measure brings us any closer to being comfortable with the high cost of healthcare in America. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Maggie's on the line. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm well. Thanks for calling. Tell me what you think.
Well, I think that we're dealing in a mixed metaphor at this point in the area of healthcare. I've been involved in healthcare for over 10 years now in the business side.
What's the business side, Maggie? Tell me what you do.
I have been past financial officer of a home care organization.
Okay.
And have worked in small doctor's offices since then, actually done billing, varying different things. I'm also married to an emergency medical technician for the fire associations on the Cape.
So you never talk about healthcare over the dinner table?
never.
Well, what do you think?
Well, from my husband's perspective, what he provides is a community service. When someone gets sick, there's an ambulance there. And there's no discussion about how much does this cost? Are we meeting the bottom line? The community has determined they want this service. And so, therefore, he goes forward as his job as a part of providing and maintaining a community. Now we get to Cape Cod Hospital, where he takes the patients, and now we're talking about a business. How do you benchmark, how do you provide quality of care when you have this mixed metaphor? We haven't defined what the real goal and objective of healthcare in the United States is. Is it a business, or is it a community responsibility? If we start there, maybe then we can decide how much it really costs and how much we really want to spend.
Is this, David, at the basis of understanding change in healthcare? Does that decision that Maggie's put before us, that choice rather, something that we have to make?
Yes. Let me rephrase it slightly. We decided after the Clinton plan failed a decade ago, we as a country decided that our biggest goal was to save money in healthcare. So we took what insurance companies said, the HMOs came along and said, you know what, we can save you money. And they did it by cutting doctors' fees and by making life miserable for some of the physicians and making life really miserable for patients.
But they did cut costs.
They did cut costs, and nobody liked it because people were worried that their health was suffering. And people, as Maggie said, when the EMT arrived, you know, when you need the EMT, people say, yes, it's worth it. This expense is worth it. And in fact, imagine if what we did is we said, well, I want you to decide before each time you call the EMT, are you willing to pay enough for it? That would create all this concern. And what people were telling us was, look, stop hassling me so much about the money. What I care a lot about my health, and I want you to figure out how to make me healthier. And once we get the focus on really, I think this is the way that I interpret Maggie's community organization. The community issue here is, how can we make ourselves be as healthy as we can in a way that's not too overbearing for us in terms of the cost? And when you do that, people will have a sense that the system is working for them rather than against them, that the wheels are not grinding whenever they feel like they need something.
Maggie, is this a little bit about the difference between universal health care as we understand it in the countries that have it and this country where health care has to come through some private sector bit of bookkeeping before it gets to you?
I think that's part of it, but I also think, as it's been mentioned a few times, we're talking healthy. The American health system is not based on health. It's based on illness. And if you go to a doctor and you're healthy, they look at you as like, what are you doing here? It's just beginning to change with your nature pathologists and your homeopaths who look at you and say, how do I stay healthy? Whereas a Western medical doctor, you go in when you're ill, and Medicare and Mass Health and your insurance policies only reimburse when you're ill.
Jim, so, preventative medicine, we've talked about this on the program before. Is that the distinction that Maggie's describing?
Again, if I could step back once more to Maggie's original commentary about our confusion between whether we're a business or whether we're a community, I think that's an important point. we are confused, and I think at two level, at the most basic level, we're confused about whether health care is a commodity or whether it's a right. Now, I believe it's a right. I would say pragmatically that it's an economically contingent right. If you live in Nigeria, there's a certain level that you're going to be able to expect and afford. But in a wealthy country like the United States, I believe it should be a right and not a commodity. Having said that, I think the mixture of whether things are provided directly by government or by businesses is a choice we can make once we've made the decision that it's a right, and then it becomes an issue of how you best distribute it. With respect to the issue of preventive services, I think that they are very important. I think that they have been neglected to a certain extent by the way the payment system is structured. But again, I think there's a lot that's going on within individual health systems to provide preventive services. And again, I would caution people, prevention's worth doing because good health is worth having. It's not necessarily going to save us money until everybody lives to 90 and then dies quickly of a heart attack. It's just going to continue to, in fact, potentially add expenses. Not a reason to not do it, but to be clear-minded about what we're doing.
To Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for our next caller. And Stephen's with us. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. So far, the conversation has been mostly on how this quality measures affect the physician.
Right.
But I was wondering if I could get your guests' opinions for in terms of the consumer, because there is some research that says that when there is quality measures for consumers, they don't actually use them. They say they want the measure, they want the information, but then if they're given information or if the information's out there, the consumers actually aren't using it, which suggests there's other things weighing into their decisions.
Do you mean the kind of consumer information, Stephen, where I would go to the hospital and pick up a sort of weekly updated brochure that would say, this physician has an A++ rating and this one's a sort of A- rating, but the A- is available and the A++ is booked up? Is that the kind of...
I was thinking, there's nothing out there right now that would really resemble that, but there is things out there that would maybe compare, let's say, nursing homes, or
right.
I believe one of your guests mentioned hospital information's out there, so it would be, you know, you would be able to get some information about comparing one hospital to another hospital.
Okay, two parts here, and let's take the first one first, and that is, when we talk about measuring the quality of healthcare, are we doing that so the insurance companies can adjust the compensation for the doctor, David? Or are we doing it so the consumer can say, gee, I need an obstetrician and I want to take a look at the ratings of, you know, obstetricians in the North Carolina area?
There are actually a few reasons to do it. One is for the insurance company to adjust compensation. Second is for patients, because it is true that many patients don't think about these things, particularly in an acute setting. Many others would like to know about the quality. If, for example, you have a child with a particular type of illness and you want to know who are the best specialists there. The third is actually for the providers themselves. A lot of what happens when we put out ratings, we show that one set of physicians is doing a better job than the other set of physicians. And that second set of physicians then says, you know what? I want to learn what they're doing that makes them better mm-hmm. than what I'm doing, because I want to do a good job. I really want to be helping my patients.
And does that, some of the pilot programs that are trying to come to terms with a useful way of measuring quality, are they already showing the kinds of results where it would be useful information for the consumer to have it?
Yes, in fact, they are. The hospital-type program we were looking at has actually shown improvements in health amongst the hospitals that have been rated. When we rate insurance plans, we observe a lot of insurance plans trying very hard to do things like give beta blockers drugs to people who have
right.
just had a heart attack, because that's one of the key measures. So just the very fact of putting those out there has forced the insurance community and the provider community to pay a lot more attention to these issues.
What would happen, Jim, if you called a meeting of the doctors at Partners and said, we're handing out a little form, it's a check thing where your patient marks, you know, on a scale of 1 through 10, they were happy with the waiting time, they were happy with the bedside manner, they were happy with the advice, and that was all going into some sort of computer system. Would there be resistance to that?
Our doctors know that increased transparency is coming. Our doctors, I believe, are prepared to deal with that, and all of the data that we have thus far shows that we would stand in good stead with that data being made available. So that's not, I believe, a major problem in our institution. One point I would want to make is that though I believe this data is important for insurers and for patients, I think we shouldn't put too much weight on trying to make the consumer the one who's responsible for all of these issues of cost and quality. Mm-hmm. I think it's simply too much to put on a consumer's shoulder. There's a huge imbalance in knowledge.
Well, it's a little bit like the Amazon reviews of books. I mean, I don't trust them because I don't know the person who's reviewing the book. You know?
Absolutely. And there are many who are trying to say that this should all be shoved on the shoulders of the consumers, make them have very high deductibles, make them make these choices. That's too much of a burden, I believe. They should have the material available, but they should get help from the payers.
David, you're nodding. I think what you're saying is it's just a part of the mix. Is that?
It is just a part of the mix. One of the things that we know is that people are very bad at making decisions when it's a really quick thing you have to do right away. And putting people in that circumstance is just a recipe for having them be upset.
Let's go to Cape Cod now. And Leslie's joining us on the line. What do you think of this, Leslie?
Hi. Good morning to all. I have a feeling that it's part of the patient's responsibility to educate him or herself. If they go in for a regular checkup, they should know what they should be getting. And when they get the test back, they should know what normal and abnormal is. I have Lyme disease, and it took me a long time for a doctor to listen to me. I knew I had Lyme disease, but nobody would believe me. And I educated myself, unfortunately. People think that doctors know everything, and they don't. It's almost impossible to know everything that's going around.
There's an interesting part of what you're saying, Leslie, that Jim was talking to one of my colleagues about, and that is the difference between those who take the time, like yourself, to study the disease and learn about it, and then the people who don't spend any time at all on that. Jim, your point, your experience at Partners is that these people who come in with diabetes and emphysema and these multiple maladies, as you talk about, these are the ones that cost the most money and don't have much research or understanding of what's wrong with them. Should they be taking advice from Leslie, or is that never going to happen?
Well, they should be taking advice from Leslie, but the extent to which it's going to happen, I think, is an open question. I think the point about the concentration of illness is important. When you're thinking about healthcare costs, 3% of the people account for 50% of healthcare costs. 10% account for 70%. So the
and
most
the 3% of the multiple malady
are
types?
The ones with multiple maladies. Now, some of them, like Leslie, are capable of and interested in doing a lot of work on their own, and that should be commended and encouraged. But the reality is there are lots of people who either are incapable or disinterested in getting involved in that level, and so we can't count on that as an entire answer.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. David, let me ask you, how important in this whole mix is a shift or a direction to some kind of change in the healthcare plan where everybody has insurance? Now, I know that little red flags pop up, socialized medicine, universal health care, and stuff like that. And maybe those are all a part of it. But can you have a system that rewards the quality of care if it's still selective, if it's still only care for some people?
You can do it. It will not be as good. You can take the people who are insured now and you can make the system work better for them. The harder part, the thing that you really can't do is squeeze all the cost out of the system, because then there would really be nothing left to care for the uninsured. It can be done, but it's not a very comfortable system. And over time, it becomes increasingly apparent that the medical system doesn't work as smoothly as it might if everybody were insured.
So is the quality that you're talking about something that operates better under a system where everybody has access to some health insurance?
It would operate better, but that's not to say that we should get held up. As frequently we have said, well, you can't do anything in healthcare until you do everything. And that's been the recipe that we followed for the past few decades, and it's gotten us where we are.
I mean, Jim, And again, both of you, you're both well steeped in Washington politics. Is this an ivory tower conversation if we talk about, you know, setting aside cost for the time being, studying the system as we know it and looking for ways of improving it? I can't imagine either one of you sitting before a Republican-led congressional committee and making the case. They'd have their hand up in front of you before you open your mouth.
I don't think it's an ivory tower conversation. Our people were down just 2 weeks ago testifying before the House Ways and Means Committee, just very interested in trying to find ways to build pay for performance into Medicare. So it's not an ivory tower conversation. Having said that, I do believe that in the political world, the issues of cost are going to continue to be with us because they're very concerned about tax levels in the current political environment. And my important statement, I believe, would be that it is important to link this to universal coverage if we're to have a high-quality system. And we're not going to get universal coverage in this country until we have a real debate about moral values, because the dominating moral value now is constant tax cuts, and we have to move to a debate about what happened to social justice as a moral value and move this issue forward.
David.
Let me come back to your issue about how does this play in a political world. Mm. There are really two big ideas that are being pushed now for what do we do since managed care has failed. The first one is what we've been talking about, which is really focus on the quality of the system, make the system high quality, bring people in as you can, but make it work better. The second is to say, well, HMOs were bad because they tried to ration people. So let's get people to ration themselves by giving them a lot of cost sharing, by making people be more responsible. Those are the two things that people are hearing. Some of what's happening now is you see pushes for high deductible insurance policies, for this being more of a market-driven system where people can afford, who can afford it, get more. That, to me, is really the alternative, is more attempts to squeeze out money. And when you say it that way, there's a lot of unease, and people are saying, you know, I'm willing to take a gamble on trying to make the system work better and see what that gets us.
The fellow who's in charge of Medicare right now is also an economist, Mark McClellan, is he a sort of secret ally with you on this? If, in fact, he's looking at quality, is that maybe where it turns?
Mark McClellan is actually a good friend and a former co-author of mine who I've done a lot of work with. And I think the Medicare's not-so-secret agenda is to try and experiment with some of these. I think it's incredibly important that the government take as big a role in this as it can. It's about half of the medical system, and you can't do anything if it's going to sit on the sidelines.
So maybe change from within. I want to thank both of you for coming in. It was good to have you here. David Cutler, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
David is a professor of economics at Harvard's Kennedy School and also associate dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences for Social Sciences at Harvard. And Dr. James Mungin, I want to thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
Jim is president and CEO of Partners Healthcare, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard as well. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.